Our scripture this morning is taken from John 21, 1 to 12. John 21, 1 to 12. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them. And they said, "We'll go with you." So they went out and got into the boat. But that night, they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore. But the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have just caught." So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. May God bless the hearing of his holy word.
So good morning to you, and happy Mother's Day. In the first service, I was talking, and I moved my hammers like this, and I've lost a lot of weight. And so my wedding ring went flying, and so there's Michelle in the back. I had to reaffirm that we found the ring, and everything's good. I'll try to hold on to it. Meredith, if you're sitting there, if you see it, just kind of field it, and we'll... For these few weeks after Easter, we're looking at resurrection appearances of Jesus. These moments where Jesus showed up in people's lives. And those stories for us are full of life. But of course, they happen in the context of people who are going through a rough time. The disciples are processing, what does it mean that Jesus has been crucified? Yes, they know he's been raised from the dead, but they're managing a huge change in their lives. What we've wanted to do is look at situations too in our lives while we're looking at the resurrection appearances where we have people in our lives who may feel in one way or another kind of like the disciples felt early on when they were first seeing Jesus alive. So in the next weeks, we're going to talk about different friends that we have, five friends. Friends who are disappointed or downcast. Last week, Doug talked about doubt, a friend who's in doubt. Friends who feel they're at a dead end. We'll talk eventually about the friend we have who hates Christians. But today it's the friend who's in grief. It's not lost on me with it being Mother's Day that it's a complicated day. And you can see that even in the little video we ran before about Mother's Day, it's like there's all these different possibilities for you and your experience of your mom or being a mom or not being a mom. And a video like that wants to try to catch everybody and articulate all those feelings and the things that God has to say to everybody. And while we're doing this today, talking about grief, I know for some people that may be difficult. I'm assuming that because it's Mother's Day, it's already difficult, that you're already maybe processing that. Now, for many of you, that's not the case at all, but for some of you, it will be. And I hope that the way we talk about this is something that cares for you or for the people that are near you. You know, when my grandmother died, my parents are still alive, but when my grandmother died, my dad's mom, she was 96. And she was a Victorian lady and sort of gentle in her posture, quite incongruent with running around in London, pulling people out of burning buildings in the Second World War. She also had that aspect of her life. But when I know her after 1970, she's a gentle little English lady with her Victorian sort of personality. And when the time came for her to pass, it was this sort of graceful, gentle exit. She had gotten to see everybody in the last week after Christmas before New Year's. She got to see all of me and the cousins, everybody else. I was living in Nova Scotia, and so I'd returned to Nova Scotia after having said goodbye. There were stories she wanted to make sure that I knew. She got to tell me those stories. And when the night came that she passed, she was in her room. They wanted to take her blood pressure. And so they came and they took the blood pressure. And as the lady left, she couldn't get a good reading on the blood pressure cuff. And she said, I'll just go get another cuff, and then we'll see if we get a better reading with that. Okay, says my grandmother. She said, I'll just lay back my head and close my eyes. And as the one nurse left, another one just entered the room right away, and my grandmother was gone. It's just this gentle, peaceful, whew. Well, of course, for me, I was living in Nova Scotia at the time. Then there's the coming home for the funeral and managing the plans and family interactions and how will all this work. There's all this kerfuffle around the experience of trying to figure out what we do next. And then I'm back to Nova Scotia, and I'm away from family. I'm away from the structures that God's used to support and put his arms around me. And as I return back, God did this really, really cool thing. There was a lady in the church I was serving. My first church was an African church. It was a lady named Edith. And Edith, she was 83 when I arrived at the church, and she was just about 86, and she became like my grandma. God did this thing where my earthly grandmother had left, and so all of a sudden God brings Edith into my life, who just stepped into that role. And then when I left out at Inglewood to come to Newmarket, Ontario, there was a lady named Mona. And as the years have gone by, God sort of rolls these other people into play in my life. I don't know if you have that experience, but I hope so. Because one of the things we're hoping for in a place like this is that we've put ourselves, by being together, not just on a Sunday morning, but as community, getting to know each other, that the Lord may well raise up someone else in the room to put their arm around you. Or maybe he raises up you to put your arm around someone else. And that together, those that we've lost, God can yet care for us and pick up the weight that they once carried. So bless you. I'm hoping that you'll be cared for by the Spirit while we're talking today. Implicit in talking about the five friends that we want to do as this series is the question of helping or being helpful. That's what we want, right? We feel the force of other people's feelings, and we want things to be different for them. If we're well-intentioned at all, that's what we want. Other people go through difficult things, and we want to either, you know, maybe quickly we want to make it go away, or we want to solve it. We want something clever to say. There's an impulse to be naturally helpful. And it's complicated because we recognize all of a sudden the thing that we might naturally do may not be so helpful. I was born with a predilection for extroversion. I talk. Which I suppose on the one hand kind of works out okay. But on the other hand, one of the risks is when I see somebody going through something difficult, I want to solve it with my words. And they're not necessarily the best thing that I bring into the room. So also for each of us, there's other things that we each bring in the room. And we got to figure out whether this is the best thing that will help care for someone. After Easter, we're always, always, always talking about the risen Christ. We're talking about Jesus being alive, that he's present. And when I say that, I don't mean just sort of theologically abstract present, like God is omnipresent, so he's everywhere. And so if you think about it right, you can kind of imagine him being here. I mean that he is here. When we're gathered in his name, he's spiritually present. I believe that he's with us in this room. And I believe that in his being with us in this room, he's not sort of generically here, that he knows each of us. He knows the particulars. He knows if I talk about grief or moms, what it is that happens for you. And I believe that his care is for you before I do or say anything. It's a great story that I love that you've heard me mention before. It's from a pastor named John Wimber, who's passed away now. John was hugely influential in the beginning of the Alpha movement. And so when the Alpha course, it's a course we've offered here at the church, started, John Wimber is one of the guys that really helps Alpha launch. And John tells this story about a time in his ministry where God showed him something, a honeycomb and a vision. What had happened is that John had been preaching for a while on healing. He'd been going through Luke's gospel. And over and over and over again in Luke's gospel, people get healed. So John had been praying and pastoring and preaching on healing over and over and over. The thing was, as the months went by, nobody in his church was healed. And so what began as sort of exciting, hey, this is something new in the life of our church, maybe God's going to do some cool things. After some time, John was starting to feel like, uh-oh, he's going to stand up and talk about healing again, and nobody believes it for a minute because nobody's been healed. They gathered together on Sunday nights. There was all kinds of chaos going on, but nobody was getting healed. And John, as it was going on, was feeling more and more embarrassed and frustrated. And frustrated with God. Why isn't God doing the obvious thing that he should do? You told us to do this, pray for people to be healed. Why aren't you doing it? So as John's going through this experience internally, he's trying to have a brave face for people. He believed that God was calling him to continue preaching on healing. It went on week to week to week. One day, one Sunday, a new couple came to the church. And when they got to the church, they heard John preaching about healing. And they were just wonderfully excited by what they were hearing. And the next morning, they called John. Because Monday morning, the wife of the couple woke up sick. The husband called John and said, look, we heard what you were saying yesterday. My wife is starting a new job, and she needs to get there. Can you come over and heal her so she can go to work? And John's like, all right. So he gets in the car, and there begins a conversation with God. His frustration. Come on, why are you doing this? Why don't you do the thing that I thought you were going to do, that I told other people you do? And he's venting out that frustration, just begging God. Would you do this? Would you do this? Would you do this? When John gets to the house, he walks in, and he kind of thought that the wife would be, you know, in her house coat in the living room, but she wasn't. She was still in bed. And the way John Weber used to say it when I heard it, it was she was so sick she'd have to die to get better. So he walks in, and seeing how sick she was, she thought, she's sick. He had no idea what he was going to do. So he prayed, but he offered a very light, like, Lord, please heal her kind of thing. And then he put all of his attention on the husband, and he began to explain how sometimes when we pray for people to be healed, they're not healed. And he was getting ready, all his rationalizations, to explain everything. But the husband wasn't looking at him. The husband looked right past him. John Wimber turned around, and the wife was out of the bed. She already had her house coat on. She asked him if he wanted her to make him coffee. And he said no. John walked outside, and on the one hand, John gets outside, and he walks outside, he's like, atta baby God! He was so excited. And on the other hand, he had this other experience too. He got in his car, and he said, Lord, I don't get it. We've prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed. This morning, I don't even know if I took it seriously, and then you did this. I don't understand. And it was as he was driving then, he saw what was like a big honeycomb in the sky. Honey was pouring off the honeycomb. And below it, there were people standing there. Some people had their arms raised, and they loved it. They were drenched in the honey, and they just loved what was being poured down from above. Other people were having their hands out like this, catching the honey. And one person would come and take it and pass it to another. There were other people, though, that hated it. John could see it as though there were people standing below who were just like, ugh, and didn't want to be touched with it. And John said, Lord, what is it? And the Lord said, it's my mercy, John. It's for everyone. And then he said, John, don't ever beg me again for what I'm already pouring out on everyone. That story had a huge effect on my ministry. At the time, I was helping as a chaplain in the hospital in Newmarket. Like clergy in the community would gather and carry a pager. And a lot of times when you walk in the room, you have no idea what to pray for. You have no idea what to do. Family's right at the edge of death, getting ready to say goodbye to a parent. And what are you supposed to do in those rooms? Is the idea that when we become Christians, we're sort of given some sort of special prayer that you say that makes it go away? Well, they never taught me that one in seminary. And I can't teach that one to you because I don't know it. But what I learned from the John Wimber story is that God's already active in the room. And so when we think about caring for people that are going through grief or suffering or hardship, part of where we want to start is assuming that God's already there. He's already at work. The difficulty for me sometimes is seeing what's going on in the room before I arrive. Where's the honey? What's God doing in there? When it comes to grief, caring for people can be complicated because the feelings that they have, the person in grief, can be so ferocious. A person in grief might be angry, but not necessarily. They may be one way today and then another way tomorrow, or in 10 minutes, depending on where things are at. You've probably heard that grief can be experienced in stages. And you remember there's five stages. Kubler-Ross talks about this. There's denial, and then anger, and then bargaining, sorrow or depression, and then acceptance. And stages isn't necessarily the best way to describe it. It's not as though you get through one and never feel that again. It's not as though one comes and you just sort of shift gears and go to the next. But grief is processional. There's movement inside grief. It's not a state. Things are moving. I think C.S. Lewis describes it like going down a valley and seeing it unfold in front of you as you go around other corners. I think of it a bit like if you were flying in a low-flying plane in a jet through the valley and you're cruising right through the rift. And you go around a corner and a new part of the valley opens up. And it's somehow different, and yet it's somehow the same. And grief can be like that for people. Racing along close to things that could take you out. And then it's the same, but it's not. Then it's different, but somehow the same. C.S. Lewis describes it another way, too. He says it's a bit grief, profound grief, like having your leg cut off and living with a stump. At one point in his book, A Grief Observed, probably one of the best Christian books on grief, he talks about living every day with the reality of loss. But then later he says this: I was wrong to say the stump of his leg was recovering from the pain of the amputation. I was deceived because it has so many ways to hurt me that I discover them one by one. When we're near someone who's going through grief, that's part of their experience. It's unfolding. It's unfolding. There's aspects to it that sort of become manifest fresh that are somehow maybe similar but somehow not. And that's part of the reason I think the emotions, the experience of anger or other feelings can rise or fall in ways that don't seem to be sort of calculable. C.S. Lewis, after he lost his wife, he named the feelings very well. You know, early in his life, he'd written a book called The Problem of Pain. And when he wrote that, he talked about pain as God's megaphone to rouse a sleeping world. But later in his life, after losing his wife, when he writes about grief, he talks about it more like God had shut the door on him and he could hear it bolted on the other side. When we're caring for people in grief, we want to be aware that that's part of their experience. Nicholas Wolsterstorff was a professor of philosophical theology at Yale Divinity School. But in some of his writings, he doesn't write as a philosopher. In particular, when he writes about the death of his son. He was 25 years old when he died. It was an accident in Austria, mountain climbing. And Wolsterstorff says for his part, I'm not angry, but baffled and hurt. My wound is an unanswered question. We all sense when we're in grief or when we're watching someone else in grief that there's some kind of conversation that's bubbling around in there that someone needs to process in some way. What kind of conversation will it be? It needs to be one with the Lord. In the middle of their grief, Peter and the disciples stood on the shore of Galilee. They were different men, but they'd returned to the same place. Their familiar place, back home. They're waiting, they're wondering, they're uncertain. What else could they do? Right? With Jesus gone, what happens next in their life? And so they went back home and they went fishing. One commentator said, never has a fishing trip been judged so harshly. Some scholars say that the story of the disciples fishing, so the disciples have turned their back on Jesus. They don't believe he's raised from the dead. That's it, we're going fishing. But there's nothing in the Bible to actually suggest that. Jesus certainly doesn't chastise them for fishing when he gets to talk to them once they're on the beach. So we aren't dealing with disciples who have a theological problem. And that's helpful for us. Sometimes when people are in grief, they're going to express those feelings in ways that don't sound like sort of good, happy Christian thoughts. And sometimes Christians get distressed by that and they feel they need to fix it or argue the person back into a nice Christian way of speaking. Let them be. Let them be. The disciples don't have a theological problem. They're in grief. And around us, when people are in grief, it's not the time to work on theology. It's not the time to try to straighten out their ideas. That's not the best thing to do. And be free from that sort of self-expectation that you put on yourself. If you feel like, oh no, I need to fix this, let it be. Trust Christ. He knows what he's doing. He's already at work. Your job's to look for the honey, not to be a bee and make it up. If we think about it, the disciples needed to eat. Professionally, they were fishermen. They hadn't been working for some time, and the practical necessities of life have got to be dealt with. They needed food. I expect that when fishermen need food, fishing is a good option. I don't think we do well to read much more into it than that. Except for this. Do you remember when Peter first met Jesus? It was when he was fishing. He was in the boat. And some of the Gospels, the story is that way. Jesus sees him fishing, tells him to cast his net over the other side, and there's a big haul of fish. And here is this moment repeated for us. They've been through all the night, and they've caught no fish. And though the familiarity of the old life might have had some charm, they're feeling the frustration of that. It's just not working. And Jesus shows up there. Sometimes when people are going through grief, it can look a bit like this. It can seem on the outside to us like the person's gone backwards somehow. They revisit old ground, old haunts, old rooms, old memories. And outside, it can seem so fruitless and pointless. We sit outside and we hear somebody talk about the same memory three or four times. And we wonder, what's the value in this? There's no fish there. You're just digging through the old stuff. Sometimes grief looks like that. But there's more value there than we probably realize. For the disciples, it was this moment where Jesus could bring them back to where he first met them. And that's what helped them recognize him in the present. Did you catch that? Sometimes when people are going through grief, as they go through memories of what's happened before, they'll recognize the way that God has been at work, bringing the person that they've lost into their life in the first place. And if they can see him there in their memories of the past, it might help them find him here in the present. It might help them find the honey here and now. And so if we see somebody sitting offshore, perhaps drifting a bit, we want to assume that. What do we do? There's a couple of things that Jesus does in the passage that are really, really neat to kind of pay attention to. It's worth observing that before Jesus says anything to his disciples, he's already built a fire, gathered some bread and fish, and he started cooking it. We know that when they get on shore, he's already there, right? He's already got fish on the fire, he's got bread, he's built the fire. Even the risen Jesus doesn't begin by speaking. For an extrovert like me, I need to say that again. Even the risen Jesus doesn't begin by speaking. That's not where he starts. He's prepared something on the beach that will care for them. That's what he does first. And then when he does speak, it's not a word of instruction. It's not a theological correction. It's not even an invitation. What's the first thing that Jesus says? He calls out a question. Haven't you any fish? And what Jesus does next is brilliant because that's the moment. Well, he tells them to do this thing that they've done before. In a sense, they kind of reenact their memory. And as they do that, John recognizes that it's Jesus. Now, remember the story of Peter first called, right? Boy, Jesus understands the particulars of how it is that Peter and the others will recognize him. Asking questions and listening to the past and what's been lost is a good first step to finding God in the midst of grief. There are things that have to happen, and if we want to help the person through grief, while they're in grief, then we want to kind of get some of this stuff right, balancing the question of presence, giving space, asking the right questions, and speaking only in the moment where we really feel that it's something the Lord has to say. Phil Zila is a professor down at McMaster University. He's at the Divinity School there. He writes a book on caring for people in suffering. And he says that when people are going through grief, there's actually three shifts or movements that are going on in their lives or that need to happen as they move towards hope. Three kinds of shifts. It's helpful to think about this. The first shift he says that people need to have is moving from muteness, like silence, being mute, to lament. Moving from muteness to lament. Suffering or trauma or grief can take away our words. I like to say that grief is kind of like an isolator. It's something where just nobody else quite gets what's going on in here. And the risk is that we silence. When we're in grief, no words can say it or capture it well. Other people sometimes seem to us overwhelmed by the truth, so we hold back talking. Or we feel that other people are just taking life too lightly, and we feel like we're crashing every party. And so we begin to self-edit as we try to find a way to actually care for each other, care for others out of our own grief. For other people who are watching us go through grief, it's complicated to know when to talk. Some people need to be free to be silent. Some people need to be free to speak. And since one of the things that can be shaken most in times of grief is our sense of power over the world around us, losing our options, our ability to control what's going on around us, then the right to speak, that a person in grief has authority over whether they'll talk or not, that's really, really important for them. That gives them a sense of some stability in a world that's slipping around under their feet. The right to speak at your own pace, in your own words, is a movement to recovering some of the options that are there for you. When we talk about speaking out of grief, we religious people have a word for that. Lament. To lament. To lament is to take grief and to put it into words. It's grief expressed. Lament may be directed to God. Lament isn't playing nice. Lament may vent anger. It is a legitimate form of prayer. Some people need to lament. Sometimes for people from religious backgrounds, that can be quite complicated because they feel a lot of things that they want to sort of throw at God, but they don't want to seem like a bad religious person, and so they bottle it. That can be very unhealthy. So I like to call it kicking God's throne, and I don't mean it irreverently. There's every risk that when I get it before the Lord at the end of time, he'll kind of give me one of those. Not kicking him, but kicking his throne. His throne is big and stable. The permutations and the shuffling of our world don't destabilize him. And so when we come in with the truth about how we feel, I think you should be able to kick that throne for all it's worth. Tell him the truth, in other words, about how you feel. And part of our role when we're caring for people in grief is to leave them the freedom or maybe even facilitate their ability to do that. Sometimes for people, the idea of being angry with God can be complicated, but he is not shocked by that. The truth of how you feel and expressing it to him is a form of worship. It's a form of worship because you recognize that he's big enough to take it, that he's knowledgeable enough to understand it, that he's compassionate enough to care about the fact that that's how you feel. When we bring him the truth of how we feel, we honor him as God, the real God, the one who made all things. For non-Christian friends who are going through grief, if the notion of God isn't a fit, there's still value in getting the grief out and expressed. I think that's how God just wired people up. Maybe not every person in every situation, but at some point, perhaps into words, but even privately, at least there's value in the emotions being expressed without editing or fear of judgment. And that's a good warning to us as we're caring for people who are going through grief. They don't need editors. They don't need a person who fixes or tries to spin, like I said, or theologically correct. You know how you feel, whatever that is. So they know how they feel. Even if they can't put words on it, it is there, waiting to be expressed. The human soul, if you will, festers without air. It needs ventilation of some kind. And I think of lament a bit like that. So we'll spend a little more time there just talking about that one. But the first movement that Phil talks about is people find hope if they can move from muteness to lament. In other words, they're looking for the hope that someone will listen, that God will listen. This is the second movement. From isolation to community. That's the hope that someone will come. Extreme grief, like I said, is alienating. No one's story is exactly the same. People so often misunderstand. They offer platitudes. People fail at critical moments. It can be painful for someone in grief to interact with others. It just gets complicated. We've all had that experience, right? At different points, maybe you haven't. But boy, oh boy, for people in grief, it's a strange and not uncommon experience that the people you thought would be most likely to rush to your side aren't there. And some of the people you never ever thought would pay attention to you, they've got the casserole at your door. It's just strange how that works out. I think of it that some people run into the fire and some people run away from the fire. And I think there's part of the call for us as Christians when we're when there's self-care happening well for us, when we're close to Christ, when we're being supported in our own wounds and weakness, that we develop and grow in the direction of people who can run into the fire. Maybe not every fire. If you run into every fire, that might be a different problem. But there are some you probably need to run into. The braving the ferocity of their feeling. Open-hearted to the fact that being close to them in pain may hurt you too. That their story and their loss will mark you. There's risk in that. And so we want in our closeness with Christ to be judicious, but open to the possibility that we are growing into people who go into the fire. Extreme grief is alienating. People need to move from isolation into community at their pace, but the hope that they're longing for in one form or another is that someone will come. Be that person. Be the one who comes. The last movement, if there's muteness to lament and there's isolation to community, the last movement he talks about is the need to move from indifference to compassion. In other words, the hope that someone will care. It's not uncommon to find people who want us to be as we were, who want us to get on with life, who want us to put down our grief and walk away. And when we feel the intensity of someone else's pain, it would be easier for us if they didn't present those things. But they need to be able to do that. And so if we're going to give care to people who've been through grief, if we're going to love and be faithful, that's part of the work for us, is to give them the space to be truthful about what's going on, and that you present to them not resistance, but compassion. Compassion is literally a word that means to suffer with. Calm with passion, to suffer with. The human soul cannot bear suffering alone. And God makes his presence manifest through you, through your presence in their life or the body of Christ. These three hopes, that someone will listen, that someone will come, and that someone will care, form a framework for us of what God can offer through us when he's caring for people in grief. John, when he's on that boat, was the first to recognize Jesus. It wasn't Jesus' words that they recognized. It was the result. It was the miracle. It was the fact that all those fish were in the net. I was trying to calculate it at 153 fish, at somewhere around 3 pounds of fish, which would be a relatively small fish. One of the ones that grows there would be about 28 centimeters. If you calculate a 20-inch fish, 12 inches around, that's somewhere 12 centimeters around. That comes into about 3 pounds, 3.2 pounds. That's about 459 pounds of fish at 153 fish. That's a lot of weight. They recognize that this is not a normal fishing expedition. Peter, as is interesting, hauls it to the shore by himself. He hauls a 450-plus pound net. That image of Peter as a big fisherman, that's probably right. John remembers what they'd seen in the beginning. That Jesus was there in the beginning, that his call was real. And their experience in grief in the midst of that memory awakens them to the presence of Christ there. And so they go to the beach and they recognize him. Not because he looks right. It's this strange moment. There's something else that they can't quite articulate. They don't dare ask him, but they know it's him. And we're left with the mystery of what that means. Except for this. Think about the resurrection appearances of Jesus. What's happening over these days after the crucifixion, when Jesus is first raised from the dead, all the way on to when he finally ascends to heaven? It's about a 40-day period where he has multiple times where he appears to his disciples. During that time, the disciples are processing their grief because it's no longer the way that it used to be. When they walked with Jesus before, they saw him in the flesh. They watched what he was like when he woke up in the morning. They knew what sleepy Jesus looked like, right? They watched him wipe sleep out of his eye. They knew what his voice sounded like after 10 o'clock. I don't know if he would have had coffee, but after his first coffee, when his voice changed, they know what the timbre of his voice sounds like. They know when Jesus is done with the crowd. They know the shape of the fingernail in his left thumb. They know all the particulars of what he looks like in the flesh because they've been physically with him. And now it's different. It's not a theological problem. They believe in the resurrection, but he's not with them the same way. It's changed. And they have to learn how to deal with the reality of Jesus risen, but not the same. This is huge for the early church. On the other side of the ascension, the early church is going to experience Jesus. They'll have visions. They'll have moments where Jesus is apparent and shows up. But it's going to be different than it was for the disciples when they traveled with Jesus. They will need to interact and see Jesus by faith. It'll be in their relationship with him that some of these other ways of experiencing and seeing Jesus will be manifest. And the disciples, they haven't been prepared for that. And so here they have this 40-day period with the resurrected Christ changing everything. There's something about their grief and this experience of change that's preparing them to be able to lead in the church to come that they can't even see yet. And I don't know about you, but I sort of assume that when things crash into my life for one way or another, that part of what God's doing is getting me ready to do other things that I have yet to see. It's not that I look forward to, you know, please whack me here so I can care for people who've been hit there. But I don't know if I've had a blow that he hasn't used in some way. And that gives me some courage. Somewhere on that beach, he's got his fire going for me. Somewhere on that beach, he's got everything I'm going to need to be fed. Somewhere on that beach, he'll remind me of all the places where he's been active before. And that's a whisper of his promise that he'll be active in the future. He will not change, even though everything else has changed. When we're close to people in grief, they need to know that that's who Jesus is. That he's consistent and stable. That he understands them. And that he's got everything they need ready for them already. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we ask for your closeness and for your word. And we ask for the wisdom to know when to use words or not. Give us the ability to see what you see when we look at the people we love who are in grief. Give us the ability to be present and silent, to be compassionate, to be active. Fill us with those things that seem lost in our world. Teach us to make casseroles and to be wise about the length of time we're with. Give us by your Spirit those moments when we represent you faithfully and well. And give us eyes to see the honey as you pour it out so that we love according to your will and do only as we see you, the Father, doing. We ask for this in Jesus' name. Amen.